Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Susan Yaki reporting. Syrian regime fails to regain control of Hama prison. Government forces have failed to regain control of a Syrian prison where nearly 800, mostly political detainees, have maintained a revolt for nearly a week. Syrian opposition leaders warn of a possible massacre of detainees in Hama Central Prison, calling on the international community to take urgent action. Conditions at the prison have deteriorated since government forces stormed the prison Friday night and managed to seize the facility's food stocks, say political activists. Videos posted by inmates on social media showed men gasping for breath after government troops fired tear gas canisters in cell blocks. Gunfire could also be heard. A 72-hour ceasefire extension in the Syrian city of Aleppo has provided some breathing space for residents. Displaced families returned home and schools reopened. Abu Ammar is a teacher in Aleppo. He says they had to stop classes for 2 weeks and now they will work at making up what was missed while the schools were closed. Islamic State-affiliated terrorists have claimed responsibility for killing 8 plain-clothed Egyptian police officers in an attack just outside Cairo in Helwan, Egypt. The gunman pulled up to the policeman's van in a small pickup truck, got out, and proceeded to open fire on the police vehicle before fleeing the scene, Egypt's state-run MENA news agency reported. It is the deadliest attack in Cairo since November, when 4 police officers were gunned down by IS fighters. From Washington, this is VOA News. North Korea's state news agency says President Kim Jong-un has told a ruling party Congress his country will not use nuclear weapons unless its sovereignty is threatened by other nuclear powers. The KCNA report today says Kim is also willing to normalize relations with states that had been hostile toward the Pyongyang government, and says Kim called for more talks with South Korea to reduce distrust and the potential for further misunderstandings. In March, North Korea threatened a preemptive and indiscriminate nuclear strike on the U.S. and South Korea in response to joint military drills. Authorities in Afghanistan hanged 6 men on death row who were convicted of grave crimes against civilians and public security. Taliban officials swiftly confirmed those executed belonged to the insurgent group and vowed to take immediate bloody revenge. The executions of the terrorists took place in a Kabul prison today on the orders of President Ashraf Ghani, his office confirmed to VOA. The move came after last month's complex suicide bombing in the Afghan capital that killed nearly 70 people and wounded hundreds more. The Taliban claimed responsibility for the deadly assault. Donald Trump, the presumptive U.S. Republican presidential nominee, said today he is not all that worried that key party leaders say they won't support him in the national election against the likely Democratic nominee, former U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. As the billionaire real estate mogul all but clinched the party's presidential nomination last week, the last two Republican presidents, President George H.W. Bush and his son, President George W. Bush, and numerous other party officials declared they have no intention of supporting his maverick candidacy. Trump was asked about the issue on ABC's This Week news show. Meanwhile, in the Democratic camp, Hillary Clinton had remarks about Trump.
When I think about what's at stake, even if I weren't running for president, I would be doing everything I could to make sure that the presumptive nominee of the Republican Party never gets near the White House.
Today is Mother's Day in the United States and scores of other places around the world. Mother's Day is a time to celebrate and appreciate all the work women do. Families traditionally give their mothers flowers and a fancy dinner to commemorate the day. U.S. President Barack Obama honored his wife Michelle in his weekly address, thanking her for the remarkable way she does the most important job, being a mom. While the U.S. Congress made Mother's Day an official holiday in 1914, Obama urged the current legislative body to pass more legislation to honor women. I'm Susan Yaki in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
We are engaged in discussions with some high-profile individuals and some political parties to form a coalition.
The leader of a Ghanaian opposition party calls on the Electoral Commission to ensure the November general election is transparent and credible.
I had a choice. Either I just retire from politics, you know, concentrate on my family and my personal life, or make a point, a symbolic point, if you will.
A prominent Zambian ruling party member defects to the main opposition party ahead of the upcoming polls.
Well, we have seen a decline or stagnation in funding since 2009, and I think one of the biggest reasons for that was the budget sequestration that happened within the U.S. government.
And a new report urges the U.S. to improve financial support for research for neglected diseases that affect the global community. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The leader of the Ghanaian Opposition People's Progressive Party says his group is in talks with other opposition parties to form an alliance to challenge incumbent President John Dramani Mahama in the November general election. Dr. Papa Kwesi Indum also told me the Electoral Commission of Ghana has a lot to do to ensure the polls are transparent and credible.
It is likely, very likely, that I would be the presidential candidate. But then we are engaged in discussions with some high-profile individuals and some political parties to form a coalition.
An alliance?
An alliance, we call it a coalition, same thing.
The New Patriotic Party, also known as the main political party, and the National Democratic Congress, the NDC, seem to be dominant ahead of the election. How challenging is it for your party to play a critical role? Kingmakers, perhaps. In the November 7 election?
Well, see, people like to say this. And unfortunately, media people, okay, like to throw this around. But it's all fine. We know that it will be a challenging, a difficult task. But that's why we have set ourselves a task and a target that we think is achievable. And our target, essentially, we say that let's make sure that at the end of this election, it is clearly established that the PPP is the alternative. Now,
well, some people are saying that as an Nkrumahist, there are two, three, perhaps four Nkrumahist parties. Why don't you come together instead of having a splintered front with the Dankwa Busia tradition, of course, with the National Democratic Congress, the ruling party at the moment? Why not start from uniting the Nkrumahist front?
It's not all just political parties. There are certain high-profile individuals in Ghana who are well-known nationally, but who also command respect and audience and so on in their areas of origin. So we are courting all of these people. Now we are in many more villages, and we are in healthy competition with others. So our ability as leaders to control these many more people is now under stress. So let no one sit anywhere and think that, oh, as for those Ghanaians, they'll take anything, and that everything in the end will be okay.
Are you confident the elections will be free, fair, credible, transparent, meet international standards?
I cannot have confidence in a system that pair the institution. You know, we haven't given them the right tools for them to even determine who belongs in a register, who doesn't belong, and where we also know that the register is bloated, is not accurate, and so on and so forth. So what we are left with is goodwill.
Before we leave, let me ask you this. What are your expectations for the November 7 general election?
What I'm also expecting is that we, as Ghanaians, will let our character show. The good side will show that no matter be the case, that we'll take the election to be just an election, and that life must go on, and that we will decide that whatever be the conclusion, that we'll work with it. We'll work with it and ensure that the land remains peaceful, that we strengthen the country, and we all work for the people to become more prosperous than before.
Dr. Papakwesi Indum is the leader of the Ghanaian Opposition People's Progressive Party. He spoke with me from here in Washington, D.C. Mulenga Sata, formerly of the ruling Patriotic Front, or PF, says he has defected to the Zambian main opposition. This because he was disillusioned and unhappy with what he says is the lack of fiscal discipline to change the country's economic outlook to improve the lives of citizens. Sata's defection to the United Party for National Development, or UPND, comes just months ahead of the August 11 general election. Sata told me he couldn't stand by and do nothing when there are things seriously wrong with the way the current administration is running the country.
I was approached by various different parties when it became clear that I wasn't particularly happy in the Patriotic Front. And I felt, you know, I had a choice. Either I just retire from politics, you know, concentrate on my family and my personal life, or make a point, a symbolic point, if you will, and join forces with another political entity to hopefully influence some positive change in our dispensation here.
Some Zambians that I spoke with said your move to UPND, basically you have shared the responsibility of carrying the torch for him, and his legacy could be in ruin in the ruling party. Your answer to that?
Well, I disagree. The legacy of my father goes beyond just the Patriotic Front. I mean, my father started in the founding party, United National Independence Party, was a significant force there, came to the MMD, was a very significant force there, eventually culminating in the creation of this party. I mean, his whole life is a testament, is a legacy, something that we can look to for motivation and guidance. With the political party, it was not a personal to hold a party. Yes, he founded the party, but he founded the party for the people of Zambia, people that bought into his ideals, of which I was one of at the time. It was never considered a political party for the Sata family, and that was something that he made clear at all points, even with myself, even with my entry into the politics of the party. I was not given anything on a silver platter. I had to start at the very lowest ranks, contesting as a councillor, serving in the lower party structures, and it was a collective spirit. So for me, at some point, if there was a divergence, as difficult, as sentimentally attached as I was to this particular party, I felt that it was something that needed to be done. But I felt that there was something seriously wrong with the government, with the PF in government, you know, currently as we stand. I could not just stand by. I mean, my father was well known for being outspoken and very frank on issues, and he had a low threshold of tolerance for looking for a politically correct term for rubbish, I'll just say, well, for things that were not correct.
What specifically were wrong that necessitated your move from the party?
You know, with politics, I mean, there's what you say and there's what you don't say. I mean, I had a privileged position where I was working, you know, in the office of the principal. I had dealings with the government, with many government officials. I had dealings with party officials who, as you say, because of my direct link to the president, would share with me their disillusionment. And, you know, it was something that with time you begin to see as well, you begin to empathize with. And, you know, with the Patriotic Front, what used to happen before is that you had to come up through the ranks to gain seniority, you know, to achieve those senior positions. What was happening now is that people were coming on left, right, and center. And some of them were quite obnoxious members to us. And these are things that were injurious to me and others in the party. Now, that in itself is not a big thing. Many things are said in politics, and you have to, one has to have a thick skin in the same. But if I felt that the party was drifting right back to the very thing that we were fighting when the PF was formed to fight the party in government, where it becomes, you know, politics of expediency rather than of principle. There's also the rampant mismanagement of the economy. You know, I don't know if you're aware that we chose but to enter an IMF program next. Now, these had been, this thing had been predicted a couple of years ago. There were proposals, recommendations that were made to cut spending, just to tighten our belts generally. There's been none of, and I feel that that sort of cavalier approach to affairs of the country is something that cannot be tolerated. We need some rigor, some discipline.
Mulenga Sata defected to the Zambian Opposition United Party for National Development, or UPND. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. A new report urges the U.S. to improve financial support for research and development for neglected diseases that affect the global community. The study's sponsors, the Global Health Technologies Coalition, or GHTC, says in recent years, public funding by the U.S. has remained stagnant or declined. The GHTC suggests reforms to provide needed funding and to keep medicines and other health products in the pipeline for global emergencies. From Washington, VOA's William Eagle has the story.
The U.S. remains by far the most important source of funds for medical research and development for scores of diseases well known to the developing world. According to the latest available data, global donors contributed over $2 billion in public funding in R&D to what the medical community calls neglected diseases. The U.S. government accounted for over 70% of the amount. But the new report says over the past 5 years, funding has largely been flat. Aaron Will Morton is the executive director of the Global Health Technologies Coalition, a grouping of over 25 nonprofit organizations. Together, they work to advance policies to accelerate the creation of drugs, vaccines, and other tools to improve global health.
Well, we have seen a decline or stagnation in funding since 2009, and I think one of the biggest reasons for that was the budget sequestration that happened within the U.S. government in 2013.
Usually, U.S. administrations make yearly budgetary requests to the U.S. Congress for funds for global health programs. In other cases, emergency requests are made. Critics say the amounts granted often fall short of what's needed to ensure the development of drugs and other health products, especially for fast-breaking pandemics. Recently, the White House announced it may divert funding for controlling Ebola to fight the spread of the Zika virus. Morton says it's a bad idea.
We aren't in the clear with Ebola. We're not done. We haven't solved the problem. We still don't have the tools we need to fight Ebola, and so we risk a lot by moving that money to fight the next public health crisis. And, you know, unfortunately, Zika happened very shortly after Ebola, and we weren't necessarily finished with that. And we don't know what's coming next. And so moving funds around from one public health crisis to the next is an unsustainable way to address global health issues.
The GHTC study asks the U.S. government to encourage private sector involvement in R&D with prizes, small business innovation awards, tax credits, and other incentives. The report also recommends improved cooperation between the seven U.S. agencies involved in global health.
Getting those agencies to work really closely together is a really effective strategy for better using the dollars that we do have. So it doesn't always have to be about new money. It can be about better using the dollars that we have. And we saw this happen with the response to Ebola, where there was great coordination between USAID and CDC and the Department of Defense around the Ebola Grand Challenges to solicit new innovations to help stop the Ebola outbreak.
The effort, called Fighting Ebola, a Grand Challenge for Development, encouraged private and public partners to share and develop ideas on improving personal protective equipment for healthcare workers. They included protective suits and hoods that remain cool for an extended period of time and that can be easily removed. Morton says the U.S. government could work with middle-income countries like Brazil, India, and South Africa to improve their own research and development efforts. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration could also provide scientific guidance to regulatory authorities as they review health products. Morton says the FDA could also help boost the regulatory capacity needed by lower and middle-income countries to adopt new medical technologies.
The regulatory authorities that oversee product development or new products or new drugs in any country are really crucial in protecting the citizens of that country, you know, from sort of adverse effects from tools or technologies that aren't effective or that aren't safe.
The GHTC report says U.S. investment has helped develop a pipeline of 500 tools that could be effective in treating neglected diseases. However, the cost of developing new global health products will likely increase as they go from laboratory testing to clinical trials. Now is not the time, says Morton, to pull back U.S. investments and put that arc of progress at risk. I'm William Eagle in Washington.
The Zimbabwean passport offices have over the years been raided by money-seeking touts who could do anything for passport seekers desperate to get to the documents for various purposes. Now this seems to be a thing of the past, as citizens can walk into the passport office, process the necessary papers, and wait a few hours or days to get their documents. For VOA, Patricia Mudadigwa has this report from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
Makombe Building has become a pleasant sight as the passport touts are no longer hounding people demanding large sums of money for processing passports. They used to demand large sums of money from people visiting the passport office as they were capable of setting up someone with passport officers at a fee. It is now easy to interact with passport officers and process one's documents without paying passport merchants, like at any public place. One can find a queue at Makombe Building, but without the pushing and shoving that had become the order of the day. Apart from that, one does not need to sleep anymore for days outside Makombe Building or any passport office in Zimbabwe when looking for a passport. And Zimbabweans like Chengeto Fusirai, who was found helping her son to apply for a passport at Makombe Building, said this is a great achievement by the Registrar General's office.
I'm no longer sleeping here. The lines are very short and the service is very good.
The situation at most passport offices eased before the recent commissioning of a passport processing plant at KG6 Army Barracks by President Robert Mugabe, which is capable of processing 16,000 booklets a day. Harare serves between 700 and 1,000 clients per day. The state-of-the-art machine is designed to quicken the process of acquiring a passport in Zimbabwe. Harare resident Ruth Phillips said, though the Registrar General's office appears to be doing the right thing, at times the processing of passports can be delayed.
We were here a good 4 hours, I would say. I came with my brother and but it's not too bad. Everything is, they've got a very good system here and you've just got to follow each rule and stuff.
Another Zimbabwean, Veronica Mainge Ama of Mutoko in Mashonaland East Province, said she was surprised to see so much order at Makombe Building when she went there seeking an emergency passport.
It has improved because before you would have to come here early, really, really early. They have so many cameras now, so many people that are serving. So I think because of that they have so many desks and people that are helping, it makes the service faster.
Efforts to get a comment from the Registrar General Tobaiwa Mudede were fruitless, as he was said to be attending various meetings in Harare. This is Patricia Mdadigwa.
South Africa's Justice Project, a non-profit monitoring traffic law, says more than 20,000 people are killed in road crashes in the country every year. It maintains that the authorities have lost control of the roads, mainly because they are failing to implement laws designed to save lives. In the second part of a series investigating the situation on South African roads, Darren Taylor reports for VOA on some of the causes of the fatalities.
Patients wait to see Dr. Wayne Corris inside a medical center in Johannesburg. A few years ago, he was training with other runners on a road on the outskirts of the city. Suddenly, a speeding vehicle screeched towards the group.
A young gentleman who claimed he fell asleep at the wheel at 5 in the morning drove into us and killed two of my friends, and I was airlifted to Mill Park. I was in a coma there for 28 days with a head injury and a couple of fractures.
Corris spent 5 months in hospital. Therapists had to teach him to walk, write and talk all over again. He wasn't able to practice medicine for 4 years. Without his income, Corris and his family battled. Johannesburg Metro Police rushed to another car crash scene. Veteran traffic officer Edna Mamonyane says most collisions happen because South Africans love to drive too fast.
For them, it's about speed and just speed. Move, move. Sometimes these people kill themselves and kill other people.
Paramedic Victor Furendijk says a lot of high-speed accidents happen in unexpected places, where the speed limit is a mere 60 kilometers an hour.
Urban roads, where you've got a high-impact collision head-on between two motor vehicles and four, five, six people dead in one car.
The Johannesburg Metropolitan Police Department, in the year 2014-2015, 81% of the infringement notices that it issued were camera speeding fines.
Howard Dembowski heads the Justice Project, an NGO that monitors law enforcement in South Africa. He says the authorities are employing the wrong strategy to prevent speeding, using speed cameras set up on the sides of roads to trap and fine offenders.
If a person is doing 250 kilometers an hour on a freeway with a speed limit of 120 kilometers an hour, how does it help you sending him a notice in the post up to 40 days after the fact, saying, we will summons you to appear before the court? It doesn't help anybody. It doesn't help me driving along with my family in the motor car when that idiot comes plowing into me.
Dembowski asserts that speed cameras are simply money-generating tools for municipalities. He says the best way to deter speedsters is through proactive policing, with patrolling officers immediately stopping motorists who drive too fast and serving them citations. There are a few police units specializing in cracking down on speeding in South Africa. Dembowski says they're doing good work, but it isn't enough.
If they happen to tackle 0.01% of the speeding infringements in this country, I'll eat my motor car on live TV.
Campaigners against reckless driving have called for serial speedsters to be jailed. But lengthy sentences for even serious traffic crimes are rare in South Africa, as Wayne Corris well knows.
The gentleman who drove into us and killed two others got 3 years house arrest, which I can't quite level in my brain, you know.
Dembowski says aggressive driving is fueling the high road death toll. That 80% of collisions in South Africa are head-on, according to state statistics, is proof of this, he adds.
Someone's playing chicken. You cannot have a head-on collision unless one or the other party is on the wrong side of the road.
Children protest against motorists driving recklessly near their school. Dembowski says frustration at the lawlessness on the roads is swelling across South Africa. For him, the rise of road rage shows citizens don't trust the authorities to enforce the rules of the road. So they're taking the law into their own hands. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Good evening, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. Reigning champions Etoile du Sahel are closer to reaching the group stage of the Confederation Cup after a 2-0 win over Gabon's Monana. Tunisia defender Zaid Bagotas opened the scoring for the hosts on the stroke of halftime, and Ihab Mskani added the second in the 65th minute. The second leg of that tie is on May 18th in Gabon, with the overall winners progressing to the group stage of the tournament. Early on Friday, it was a goalless draw between Al Ahli Tripoli and Misri El Makashar of Egypt. That game was played in Tunis because of the ongoing security concerns in Libya. The tie will now be decided on May 17th in Egypt. Etoile and Al Ahli Tripoli had begun the 2016 season in the African Champions League, the most prestigious and richest club event on the African calendar, alongside TP Mazembe of the DR Congo. Reigning African champions Mazembe fell by 2 goals away to Wydad Casablanca and were held at home with the Moroccans equalizing in stoppage time. Etoile and Mazembe have won 9 Confederation of African Football titles each, achievements surpassed only by Al Ahly of Egypt with 18 triumphs. The silver lining for Etoile is the motion to the Confederation Cup gives them a chance to win the competition twice in a row after beating Orlando Pirates of South Africa in the final last year. Mazembe host Stade Gabessien, a Tunisian outfit competing in Africa for the first time and so far unbeaten in the qualifiers. 3 days after winning the South African title, a record-extending 7th time, Mamelodi Sundowns face Madiama of Ghana near Pretoria. Young Africans must tame Angolan club Esperanza Sagrada in Dar es Salaam if they hope to become the first Tanzanian team to reach the group stage. The match between Stade Malien of Mali and FUS Rabat of Morocco pits former Confederation Cup title holders against each other in Bamako. Melodia Bejia of Algeria against Esperance of Tunisia and Al Merrikh of Sudan against Kwakaba Marrakech of Morocco complete the first leg schedule. Meanwhile, the Libyan Football Federation, LFF, has confirmed the Libyan Soccer League will resume on May 15th. The league has been suspended since 2014 season because of the security troubles in the country. LFF chairman Anwar Al-Tishani is reported to have said, quote, "We had meetings with the heads of the clubs, official authorities, security officials, and the conditions look suitable to start the 2016 league." On Thursday in Tripoli, the LFF conducted the draw for the season. Finally, Julius Chepkwonyi and Jane Kipto made it a Kenyan double at the Harmony Geneva Marathon on Sunday. With temperatures reaching 20 degrees Celsius by the race's conclusion, the winning times were understandably modest. Chepkwonyi, a winner at the Venice Marathon last October, made it 2 marathon wins in a row when crossing the line in 2 hours, 11 minutes and 10 seconds, well outside his best of 2 hours, 9 minutes, which was run in Daegu 2 years ago. This was Chepkwonyi's first win in Geneva. The same couldn't be said of the defending women's champion, Jane Kipto, who took victory in the women's race in 2 hours, 35 minutes and 3 seconds, well outside her best of 2 hours, 31 minutes and 21 seconds set in Dusseldorf 2 years ago. The 33-year-old Kenyan retained the title she won last year in 2 hours, 35 minutes and 44 seconds. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports.
It's Young John, the wicked producer.
And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent. Enjoy.
Hey, 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 hey
I'm on bar. Another stars, them they feel my demo. Look at them, them I look me him. Now the prince of FBZ. No be rice, no be beans. Make you no mind anything them talk. Make you no mind anything they yeah. No go talk anything they like. But now you get your life up.
The more you look, the less you see. Don't fall for God as you are looking at me. You they do your face like Minchi Minchi. Now you won't follow me, cause I'm on the show. I just see me so, I they shine, shine. My baby self, she they shine, shine. Money came from my hand, I go for a little. I've been there, for ground, no go for
a little. Everybody come close out. Sade wa, so man, I feel like bow. Cause you wish me well, oh, well, oh. You must follow me, Chuck. From Ninja to Yankee. Overland, overseas. Look, open doors at the sea. Where is the master key? Tisha, all the man them. When I hear me, all the girl them. When I hear me, call Alacha. Where Alachi, left they don't rest. Plenty Achi. Getting money, oh plenty. Look, looking at me, oh plenty. Now we getting money, oh plenty. Makatuku, my pocket, no go empty. Make the fire burn on the enemy. Make the fire burn on the enemy. Look, 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 them just to follow me. Look, 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 them just to follow me. Cause I, you in a gala, I chop. In a gala, I chop. Nani Jehovah, Bunyamre. Nani Jehovah, Bunyamre. Everywhere I'm going, people they be scoping. Everywhere I'm sitting, people they be talking. Baby, see what I'm chopping. See the way she's looking, see the way she's dancing. That must be why I get.
Enemies, they made.
Everybody love it.
say I did for to, you know. I it just saw the needle, it just say, you know. Make I know that you won't feel past what she say, you know. You know, I I'm a pretty boy, you know. I am a little more than so, I like me, you know. I what you got to show, no show, you know. She got tight, she got go through the banana, go feel for you.
You know, I'm calling me Bado, you know, and I'm getting the dough, you know, and I'm killing the show, you know. I'm gonna get all the show, you know. You know, I saw me come to her, oh, Kenny. I'm watching Tolle, oh, Paro, Johnny. Only I live, I say, Calipa. I want you, Calipa, don't you say? But I saw Calipa, Calipa, down.
Our Sunday music spot. I hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. Recently, the president of South Africa, Jacob Zuma, awarded a national honor to Winnie Mandela, the former wife of Nelson Mandela of Madiba, for her services during the anti-apartheid period. Because of her ill health, the award was received by her daughter. Interestingly, the award was given shortly after Mrs. Mandela lost a case for the custody of the home in which she and Mr. Mandela had lived. It may be recalled that when Mr. Mandela's will was announced after his death, Mrs. Mandela got the short end of the stick. So the loss of the case was some degree of humiliation. The sad chapter in the anti-apartheid period was the deterioration of the relationship between Nelson Mandela and Winnie Mandela after his release from prison. Views are divided in South Africa. The majority point of view, mainly within the ANC, was that judging by the conduct of Winnie Mandela while her husband was in prison and immediately after he was released, left no alternative but a divorce. A minority differs. They believe that even if Winnie Mandela was not Caesar's wife, our struggle in favor of the people of South Africa during the apartheid period justified another fate. She was the face of the ANC during the apartheid period. Our stamina, remarkable struggle, made the people of South Africa concerned about continuing the anti-apartheid struggle. Now, there is a feeling in Africa that Africans have the bad habit of forgetting their heroes and heroines. In fact, with the passage of time, they tend to denigrate their erstwhile heroes and heroines, a sharp contrast to other continents and peoples. So I think it is remarkable then that President Zuma recognized that something had to be done. Of course, the ANC has always revered Winnie Mandela. Even after the divorce, she played a significant role within the ANC and in the parliament. And it is therefore important that the history of South Africa should not forget the remarkable role that Winnie Mandela performed in the anti-apartheid struggle. Who could ever forget that glorious day when Mandela came out of prison hand in hand with Winnie Mandela? That is the kind of remembrance that South Africans should always keep in mind when they think of Winnie Mandela. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. And from the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Shaogang Chang, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, he who is guilty is the one who has much to say. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Continued economic growth in the Western Hemisphere will require making the right choices now, said U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry in a speech at a reception for the Council of the Americas' 46th Annual Washington Conference of the Americas and the U.S. Caribbean Central American Energy Summit. The most effective means to promote economic growth in the hemisphere is through trade. The best way to nurture prosperity and economic opportunity for all is to extend the benefits of free and open trade and investment across the entire hemisphere, said Secretary Kerry. The United States has free trade agreements with a dozen countries in Latin America, more than in any other part of the globe. Secretary Kerry went on to say the Trans-Pacific Partnership includes the strongest labor and environment standards ever negotiated in such an agreement and ultimately is going to benefit every single country along the Pacific Rim. The United States is committed to working with countries in the hemisphere to continue transforming the Americas into an open, integrated platform for global success, encouraging innovation and driving growth. A second priority must be supporting entrepreneurs and innovators as they strive to get new businesses up and running. With this goal in mind, President Barack Obama set up the Small Business Network of the Americas to connect thousands of small business service providers throughout the hemisphere. Another program, We Americas, specifically focuses on supporting women entrepreneurs in order to increase women's economic participation. Economic growth depends on the rule of law. That's why governments in Latin America need to promote accountability and transparency in government institutions. Corruption cannot be tolerated, as it robs a country of its future. Corruption steals not just money from citizens, it steals their trust in government. An important growth market for the countries of the hemisphere will be the energy market. It is already a multi-trillion-dollar global market with some 5 billion users. Renewable energy is growing, said Secretary Kerry. In order to take advantage of this market, the U.S. Agency for International Development is providing early-stage grant support for clean energy project development, joining a host of other U.S.-funded renewable energy projects in the Caribbean and Central America. The United States stands ready to support trade, government transparency, and entrepreneurship in Latin America. Such pro-growth policies, along with investment in the energy sector, bode well for boosting prosperity among all people of the Western Hemisphere.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.